Google's autonomous car computers are now considered drivers. Twitter tweaks the timeline and our worst tech gripes of 2016. All that and a whole lot more on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com. Hi, everybody. It's time for our annual audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It helps us understand our audience better, know what you like and don't like, how you listen to the show. It also helps us tell advertisers what kind of people listen. But I promise you, your feedback is always kept personally anonymous. All you have to do is visit twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. It'll just take a few minutes and it'll help us make Twit even better. We really appreciate your support and any help you can give us. twit.tv/survey.
This is Tech News Today, recorded Wednesday, February 10th, 2016.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by PillPack, a full-service pharmacy that combines modern technology, convenient packaging, and personalized service to make your life easier. Visit PillPack.com/twit to save $20 on vitamins and OTCs when you transfer your prescriptions.
And by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost automated investment service and the most sophisticated way to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit Wealthfront.com/TNT and sign up to get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's Wealthfront.com/TNT.
And by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your home. Right now, get free expedited FedEx shipping when you go to Ring.com/TNT. Hello and welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we talk about the tech news with people who are passionate about technology. I am Megan Maroney.
And I am Jason Howell, one of two Jasons on today's show. Mm-hmm. So, and one of two Jason H's on today's show. It's going to get a little confusing, I have a feeling.
Mm-hmm.
If you need to ask either Jason Heiner or myself a question, I suppose you just say our first and last name.
Okay.
Jason Heiner of Tech Republic is joining us today. How's it going, Jason?
Hey, great to see you guys. Pleasure to be here, as always.
Yeah, it's awesome to get you on Tech News Today. Now, we also have one of your cohorts, your CNET / CBS Interactive cohorts, coming on the show today as well.
All right, should we start in with the news?
Yeah,
you ready?
Let's do it.
All right. Late yesterday, the National Highway Traffic Safety Agency, or the NHTSA, responded to the head of Google's self-driving car project with a letter, a public letter on their website that said, among other things, that the computer in Google's robot car could be considered a driver. Joining us to talk about this letter is Wayne Cunningham, senior editor at CNET's Roadshow. Welcome, Wayne.
Ah, thank you.
So in what sense was the NHTSA considering that the computer in the car could be a driver?
Well, it sounds really interesting. It's, you know, and from a philosophical perspective, it's kind of fascinating. But this is really just in how Google builds its cars. The NHTSA, NHTSA, has a lot of regulations, safety regulations about where, you know, steering wheels are placed, where pedals are placed, how bright the headlights are. And all these are generally designed around the idea of having a human driver in the driver's seat, like on the left front seat. So Google asked them, well, what if we have a computer driving the car? So NHTSA looked at that and considered the request and then said, well, okay, we could consider the computer as the driver, you know, because actually Google suggested a couple of different, you know, scenarios. One would be the computer's the driver. One would be that these regulations don't apply whatsoever. But the NHTSA said that, let's consider that computer to be the driver. And therefore, you know, if we're talking about, like, say, where the brake pedals are placed, they have, you know, the regulations call for brake pedals to be placed in an area where where the driver can access them. And so if it's a computer driver, well, it's an electronic actuation. So that satisfies NHTSA's requirements.
So when Google first proposed the cars, they wanted to have no steering wheel, right? And no, no brakes outside, right? And then they said, no, you have to have the controls so the driver can take over if they need to. Does this mean they no longer have to have all those controls? Or like you're saying, they don't have to be, the brake doesn't have to be at foot level?
Well, they actually still have to have those controls because of the fact that This is really just a federal determination on how Google can build these cars. Yet, when you're talking about actually testing these on public roads currently, California actually requires that they have a driver in the car, somebody who can take over control of the car. And pretty much any other state that is allowing this sort of testing on public roads is going to require that, you know, a driver be able to take control of the car if there's a problem. This is, of course, you know, in this development testing phase we're in right now. So the states really are going to require that they have these controls at this point.
So the car can be considered a driver, but what you're saying is the car could not be considered a designated driver.
that's what we're all looking for in the future, I think.
At some point, probably.
Yeah, but this really just gives Google some leeway going forward to design these cars, you know, with the anticipation that states are going to see that they work, see that they don't hit things, or maybe probably drive better than as human drivers. And in that case, that really gives Google the ground to like design these things, you know, start construction and, you know, get to that second level of testing. There's actually a term for cars that self-driving cars that don't have controls for a human driver. They call it level 4 self-driving cars. They go down to these levels, down to level 0, which is a completely, you know, human driven car, up to like this idea of a level 4, which has no human controls whatsoever.
Are those on the road, the level 4? Are they able to test those on the road?
Not in California. I don't believe in Nevada. You know, still the states are requiring that there be a human in control of the car or able to take over control of the car, you know, immediately if something happens. So, yeah. You know, at this stage, we're not there. But, you know, the idea is that going forward, we would get there.
Nevada and Arizona and Michigan seem to be, you know, not surprised there, seem to be where a lot of the testing is going on. Question though, Wayne, is, was there any talk about the liability? Because, of course, that's what one of the biggest questions hanging out there. So if this sort of software driver, this AI driver in the Google car, is there, then does that mean that the liability, if there's an accident, is Google, you know, the car as a car company, in this case, accepting the liability for any errors that it might make and any, you know, damage that it might cause to, you know, person or property?
You know, this sort of ruling, this interpretation of the rules by NHTSA doesn't exactly go that far, but I could see ripples coming out from this because what this affects is a huge document that NHTSA has that governs motor vehicle safety. And the motor vehicle safety document covers all these things I mentioned, where all these elements are placed in the car and how accessible they are to a driver. So, you know, given that that document is focused on safety, I could see some, you know, ripples going out eventually. But, you know, it certainly doesn't make it so at this point. And that's going to involve, you know, whether it starts off with upfront regulation about those types of things or, you know, it starts off with lawsuits. We'll have to see how that comes out.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see, like, does it have to play out in the courts or is this going to be played out in regulations first? Or will there be a some kind of relationship or agreement or settlement between insurance companies and regulatory bodies before these things ever hit, you know, the road at level 4? We have a good thing on Tech Republic about the difference between from level 0 to 4 and sort of the difference of each of those. And also there's what they're calling kind of level 5 even now, which is a little more practical version of level 4. So it's fascinating, but it will be interesting. And an important thing that has to play out is certainly the regulations around this have to be there, as well as the cultural issues of, you know, what as a society will we accept in terms of these vehicles and their level of safety and the you know, the potential choices between because the software is going to have to decide, do we stop and not run into that dog? And but potentially the people in the car could get whiplash, or do we, you know, hit the dog and you know, save the people? You know, those are decisions that are going to have to be made in software, and there's going to have to be some societal consensus around that. in the journey between here and when these things are much more common, which is coming faster than I think any of us expected.
Well, we're going to lead up to this, to the self-driving car in a kind of gradual way. Like right now we have a lot of systems in cars that do some of the driving for us. If you look at traction control systems or adaptive cruise control, you get a little more advanced, or lane departure prevention systems. So what I see is we're going to add these features slowly, year by year to cars. We'll probably at some point in the near future have a highway pilot kind of thing that'll just let you, let the car drive for those long, hundreds of miles on the highway or freeway. And once, once people get comfortable with that, then you go to the next level, which could be, a car that can drive itself around a suburban area. I think we'll slowly be introduced to these things. So when we get to the completely self-driving car, it won't be as much of a surprise, and regulations may have already been designed to fit these situations.
I absolutely think that's true. I know the frog in the pot, boiling in the pot of water, is sort of an urban legend. They actually do jump out of the water, but that's the only thing I can think of that we're sitting there and we don't notice the water's boiling and boiling around us until all of a sudden, a computer is our designated driver.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, Wayne, thank you so much for joining us. Tell people where they can find you.
Oh, so let's see. It's cnet.com/roadshow. We've launched a new site to cover automobiles and automotive tech at CNET. It's called Roadshow. We're doing a lot of cool stuff here. So, yeah, come and check it out.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Wayne.
Take care.
See you, Wayne.
Thanks.
All right, so we've been leading up to this moment for a few weeks now, I feel like. And when it comes to Twitter's earnings that were announced this afternoon, possibly its most important earnings call to date, things aren't looking so hot. Profits did okay. Twitter seems to be making money. Met expectations, revenue of $710 million for Q4. Twitter failed to add new users for Q4. This is a first for the company. 320 million users, that's up 9% year over year, but the same as last quarter, 3 months ago. If you take SMS users that use Twitter through the SMS service out, it drops down to 305. The main fear here has been that Twitter can't grow at this point, and this is kind of confirming that. Is this pretty bad news, Jason? What do you think?
Yeah, they're clearly, going through an identity crisis. Twitter, they're trying to decide what they want to be and what they want to do. And they're clearly not Facebook. And that's the biggest problem for them on Wall Street. Facebook is an absolute money machine right now because they know so much about their users, right? They've spent years and years collecting more and more data, almost avariciously. But very smartly about their users. And because of that, they can target users much better and their ads are more effective. And, they rely to advertisers. Twitter is just not quite the same story. And in many cases, they're trying to use the same business model. But they don't know as much about their users. And I think that ultimately it, boils down to that on a business perspective. On a user perspective, it's still one of those things that they're fighting an uphill battle if they're trying to be Facebook, which really for the last 3 or 4, 5 years is kind of the course they've been on. And that's a battle that it just doesn't look like they can win. It's never looked like they could win. And clearly they're not doing well in that. When Twitter was doing really well was when it was an open platform and they had developers, developing different kinds of clients and all of that. And Twitter's, Twitter, the company, their argument was, well, that's not very sustainable and it's more confusing to users. And if we really sort of cut off the API and we have this one unified experience, then we can, refine it and we can build a product that's going to be easier for new users to understand and all of that. And as logical as some of that sounds, it just hasn't played out for them. Their user growth, has stalled, and that, strategy hasn't worked. Their user growth was much stronger, much better when it was an open platform. And so there are, people, myself included, who've said that really they should go back to an open platform and more being make money on what their greatest asset is, which is their data on sentiment analysis. and that kind of thing. And then use that in really smart ways to sell to businesses, sell to users, and become more of a data company and advertising. Because advertising isn't working very well. And also when they were a data company and they had this open API, they had this opportunity to bring in developers and let people shape what their platform, mm-hmm. their users shape what their platform is going to be. And you know, more of a kind of an open source approach. So that's kind of where they're at right now. And it's not a very good place to be if you're Twitter.
Well, Anthony Noto, the CFO, said, you know, that they're changing their focus. And one of the things he said was the developers, yeah. like developers are going to be part of our focus. So I guess they know that. The other thing they said was live. Live was going to be, I think he said, you know, live. Twitter is live commentary, live connections, live conversations.
Live video with Periscope.
Yeah. So breaking news, entertainment, sports. Yeah. So, you know, which is interesting that on the same day is when they announced this algorithm that they're going to use for the timeline. So it's not that they're, it's opt-in still, but
yeah, it'll just do its own thing, right? It'll automatically show you the cool stuff you might have missed, and it'll be much more like Facebook, right? So they're talking out both sides of their mouth a little bit. They're yeah. like, yeah. we're going to be all about live, and we know that that's the thing that makes us unique and different. Like Twitter is the live internet, which it is. Like that's their greatest value. But at the same time, if you missed stuff and we want to make this easier and we're going to be more like Facebook, where we're just going to kind of show you what we think might be most interesting to you based on what we know and who you interact with the most and who you might have missed. They kind of already have that now with the, you know, what you missed, you know, feature.
While you were away.
Kind of thing. While you were away. Sorry. Yep. Thank you, Jay. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the challenge with them is they're not exactly sure which way to go. And so they're kind of hedging their bets by, you know, having this kind of lack of focus and doing both, talking out both sides of their mouth about who they are and what's important to them.
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea. The algorithm is interesting to me. But I don't have it yet. It's not part of a feature for me yet. I do like the idea, but I get that normal people would like that idea also. I played around. The while you were away is interesting. I'm not sure exactly how it works. I get a lot of Jason Howells in
well,
my
of
while
course
you're away.
You do.
But the algorithm seems to think that I am interested in what Jason has to say because I engage with him on Twitter.
Well, yeah, it's a lot of signals, right? It's tweets you interact with, topics you're interested in, activity of people that are similar to you. Mm-hmm. You see a lot of that too. I'm interested to see how this goes, only because I actually find that while you were away kind of breaks up my experience in a way that I don't like. Like actually one thing that I notice about while you were away is it'll ask you if you like it and I say no. And it still keeps coming back. So I don't know if I'm just telling Twitter, you know, giving them a signal that I'm not very happy with it. But they're like, yeah, well, we're still going to give it to you. But I don't know. Like, I just have a way that I use Twitter. And for some reason, that just kind of that messes with me. And I'm kind of like, yeah, just get that happened a while ago. I'm not logging in to see what happened a while ago. With Twitter, I'm logging in to see what's happening right now. Mm-hmm. And that remains to be seen whether this change will be good for the wider user base. I know for me, it remains to be seen.
I wish that was a tab. I mean, I do find some usefulness about while you're away sometimes. And it does show me things that I did miss. And I probably, because my feed is so long, even though I kind of call it.
I'm looking forward to seeing the changes, but I don't know if it's necessarily going to turn the tide for Twitter. It's got to be one of many changes that people connect with. And that's the most important part. All of you YouTube Red subscribers, how many? Okay, well, we've got one running the prompter. can finally watch the new original content. And so, you know, they've been teasing this for a while. Today was the rollout date for four pieces of original content geared for subscribers of YouTube Red. I actually checked out a few of them pre-show. And I will say, like, sitting down to watch these, I felt like I was getting away with something because normally I'm, like, reading articles. And instead I was watching, you know, PewDiePie or A Trip to Unicorn Island. Let's just put it this way. Okay. So I watched a little bit of all four of the sampling of the videos that were released. And I get a very kind of like direct to video kind of feeling when I watch some of these, but I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing, because again, when you take the platform and you take a look at the platform, it's much like, you know, content that you see going on Snapchat, and you're like, oh, politicians going on Snapchat and they're putting out big bubbly letters and everything, and it feels so patronizing. But then again, there are people on that platform that's just what they're used to seeing. And I think the same kind of goes with YouTube. Laser Team, which is a sci-fi feature length film, essentially, giving it a thumbs up. Did you watch it? Okay, so Chris, our teleprompter operator, watched it. He liked it. I thought it was, you know, it was kind of interesting in the little bit that I watched, but I felt like some of the effects were a little shady, to say the least. Not super, you know, up to snuff compared to, like, let's say Hollywood or whatever. So that would kind of pull me out. Scare PewDiePie is a reality comedy show where, you know, PewDiePie kind of encounters real life reenactments of his favorite horror video game scenes. I mean, this is content that is geared at people who are already huge fans of YouTube and already huge fans of these particular people. And I'm not sure in and of itself if that's enough to drive subscribers to YouTube Red.
I don't know. I mean, I have a 12-year-old, and she has Meg DeAngelis, who was one of these other, she is a gymnast and a cheerleader. She's another one that will have content on there. She likes all of these YouTubers, and we actually went and saw YouTubers. Like, went to a meetup and paid for tickets to go see them. So, and there were lines out the door. So there are, these mini communities of people that are, and you know, they...
And not very many.
Right. And what it was, like, I wouldn't say that the viewers of these YouTubers were paying for the tickets. It was the moms of the viewers.
Sure.
So I wonder if that's what's going on here too. Like, this is all people that are, you know, kids that are still at home, you know, whose parents might want to pay for the content. I'm not sure. And it's also going to be interesting whether this is good for creators of content or not. Hank Green, who's a huge YouTuber, one of the YouTubers that Obama interviewed, says, you know, he has a thing up today about whether, and he says it's good for consumers. It's worth your money is what he says, but it's not necessarily good for the creators. And so, you know, we're showing this now. He has a little spreadsheet that he has that he wants creators to go and tell how much money they get from their channels. And it's interesting because, you know, YouTube is really, they hide how much money they're actually getting versus what the creators are getting. And now it's even a little more confusing with YouTube Red.
Jason, are you going to rush out and watch Scare PewDiePie on your next break?
No, not yet. Not yet. But I do think overall that the YouTube, I think that what they're trying to do with YouTube, where they're trying to make it, you know, a premium experience, is an interesting thing. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I think with YouTube is most valuable that is often, you know, underrated or not talked about as much is the value of all of the how-to content. That stuff is super valuable. You can go on to YouTube now and learn how to, like, you know, fix your car. You can learn how to, you know, create different dishes, food. Mm-hmm. You can learn how to fix, you know, computers, fix your printer, fix all kinds of.
Yep. Even Lily Singh, actually, and she's the trip to Unicorn First Island, you know. She's all about, you know, dancing and all this kind of stuff, showing people. No, sorry. It's a Dance Cap. That's right. Dance Cap. Meg DeAngelis. She's a YouTuber that you were talking about. Mm-hmm. Lots of, you know, kind of tutorial videos around cheerleading and gymnastics. And that's a big, big benefit to this, Jason.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of value, much more value than there was, you know, several years ago to YouTube. And so I just would be interested to see if, you know, is there going to be part of YouTube that's more like lynda.com or like even some of these like online courses, right? The massive online courses, MOOCs, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I would be really interesting to see if YouTube embraces that part of their business model and, you know, content model and that kind of thing. So I know that's a little bit of a left turn from where we're at, but that's what this really makes me curious. Like, could they do something like that with YouTube Red? Would that be another product? It'd be interesting to see.
I mean, I think that would reach even wider than kind of the narrow. Well, I say narrow group because it doesn't involve me. You know what I mean? It's like I'm not necessarily interested in this content. I know a lot of people are. What you're talking about, Jason, would also include people like me. And I think that brings greater value to it. I just don't know if we aren't already getting that on YouTube, you know?
Well, all the great content on YouTube has to have a narrow audience. Otherwise, it would have already yeah. going somewhere else. I mean, yeah. that's the thing. It's like it has a very strength. Devoted, narrow mm-hmm. audience.
Fair enough.
Yeah. I wonder if it could become a platform where you could, you know, you could put some of these how-to videos there, but you could use it as a way to like launch whole courses, you know, on things mm-hmm. If you're a content creator.
All right. Well, coming up next, why browser tabs are garbage. But first, let's take a minute to thank the sponsor of this episode. We are parents, Jason and I, which means our kids are walking germ factories. They're just teeming with germs and gross things. They get sick. We get sick.
True.
The very last thing in the world that we want to do is wait in line at a pharmacy for prescriptions or for OTCs. But PillPack is the future of the pharmacy, and it's available now. PillPack delivers your medications and vitamins pre-sorted in these easy-to-tear packets labeled with the date and time for each dose.
There we go. All right. Sorry, I had to get the box out. I apologize. Here we go.
Nice. Oh. Easy to tear. Get rid of that antiquated Monday to Sunday pill box.
I'm going to take it out of the bag, too. I'll hold that
those aren't
later.
Really your pills, so please don't take them.
Yes, I won't.
PillPack utilizes robots to sort and fill personalized pill packs separately for each customer. Each packet dispensed in the pharmacy is sent through an image recognition system that is built to ensure the right pill is in the right pack. Their system can detect dispensing accuracy by size, shape, color, and density of each pill, and catalogs an image of every single packet dispensed. Also, each packet is checked by a pharmacist for accuracy and interactions prior to shipment. They do not just trust the robots. If you ever have any questions, their pharmacists are available to you 24/7 from the privacy of your own home. No more long lines or awkward pharmacy encounters. They proactively contact your doctor to manage your refills so you never run out. Switching is easy. Sign up on their secure site and they will take care of everything for you. It's compatible with most major insurance plans, including most forms of Medicare Part D. No extra costs beyond your standard copays. Shipping is always free. They were recognized by Time Magazine as a top 25 invention. There's also a PillPack medication reminder app for the iPhone and the Apple Watch. PillPack has brought the pharmacy into the digital age, and once you make the switch, you'll wonder how you ever lived without it. Visit pillpack.com/twit to sign up now. It only takes 5 minutes to sign up. When you use our link and transfer your prescriptions to PillPack, you'll get a credit for $20 worth of vitamins and OTCs. That's pillpack.com/TWIT. And now is the time in the show where we get to complain. Yes, yes, our lives are all great. I'm grateful for everything I have. But would it be so hard for someone to let me use my phone instead of the stupid plastic fob to access the security lock on our office door? No, it would not. Here to join us to talk about the biggest tech gripes of 2016 is Jeff Fowler from the Wall Street Journal. Welcome, Jeff.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's just start with your number one gripe. What is it?
Number one gripe on our annual list this year is distracted Uber and Lyft drivers. I have had way too many incidents where you get in that car and they're like running three or four different phones there. They're working for every imaginable ride-sharing service, and they got to keep futzing with it. And it's pretty clear at this point that distracted driving is dangerous. And yet we've had this whole industry sprout up kind of based on the idea that drivers need to be futzing with phones while they're on the road. And I think there are some things that these companies could do to make that safer.
Yeah, it's part of their job to be messing with the phone. That always scares me. What about longer battery life?
Oh, my gosh. So this is the one. So we do this list every year. This is the one that made our list last year as well, the one repeat. You know, Apple keeps coming out with these devices and they always brag, oh, they're thinner than ever. But honestly, I would actually take a phone that is double the thickness of my current iPhone if it would give me longer battery life. You know, Apple came out with these really kind of ugly battery cases this year. They're sort of first actual acknowledgement that battery life is a problem. People are actually carrying these around because with these kind of humpbacks on them, because it, like having a phone that can last all day is like getting a second lung, right? So really, guys, it's time to focus on battery.
Yeah, I feel like that's right at the top of my list, right? And I know at least in the world of Android, that's if you were to ask most people like what their dream, you know, let's say spec list would be, battery, good battery life, a large battery would be right at the top of the list, just because that's the thing that affects you almost more than anything else. If your device can't turn on because you ran out of battery halfway through the day, like game over. You can't use it anymore. None of your other features matter. So,
say that, but then you look at companies like Motorola and HTC that have, you know, have not spent a whole lot of time on design over the last few years, and immediately they did and said, we're going to put more into features, including in some cases battery, especially in Motorola's case, but their sales tanked, you know, and there may be other reasons combined, but it's tough, you know. It'll be interesting to see this phone, the new Huawei phablet, the Mate 8, you know, they touted that as the number one new feature, that it gets like 2 days of battery life. I think in testing, it's actually come out to about a day and a half, at least like CNET's testing. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see they're trying to tout that as their number one feature. We'll see if that flies with buyers.
Well, yeah, that's the thing about the 6 Plus or the 6S Plus that I have. And everyone says like, oh, isn't it so big? And it's like, I don't even notice it. First of all, I would never go back to a smaller phone. And also, the battery life, for me, that's everything. I'm thinking of like getting a bigger Apple Watch because that battery is a slightly bigger. You know, I wear the women's Apple Watch and the battery doesn't last the end of the day. And, you know, it's like, oh, well, if I had a bigger watch, I'd have a bigger battery. So I don't know. Okay, let's move on to the typewriter and swooshing sounds in when we're texting. Do we still need those?
We do not. What's more annoying to being in a quiet place and hearing someone go tap, 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 tap? Time to go.
Well, it's interesting because, yeah, I mean, you point out that maybe someone still needs it, but don't make it the default, like make it turn off by default. Yeah, I think I worked at home for many years by myself and I always had my sound on. And it wasn't until last year when I started working in an office where I realized like, oh, wait a minute, like mine's the only phone making noise. And, you know, you just turn it off automatically, which is smart. And okay, what about the key fob? I want to be able to open my car with my phone. I want to be able to open my door with my phone. Why can't I do that yet?
Exactly. Do you remember the Jerry Costanza wallet from Seinfeld? It was so thick. Mine still looks like that, even after all these years of them promising the phone's going to replace the wallet.
Yeah.
You know, the technology is in these phones now. It's got the NFC. It's got the fingerprint ID. Why don't we have mobile driver's licenses? And why can't we pay for a BART ride with our phone? I understand that there's a lot of infrastructure that has to go in place for that to work, but it feels like that should be coming much sooner than it is.
Yeah, and if it's going to come, like with mobile payments, for example, the reason that your wallet is still that thick, at least in my case, the reason that I still carry around all my credit cards and I still, you know, do mobile payments is because it doesn't work 100% of the time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of my biggest gripes lately has been just with technology that promises to do something out in the name of convenience, but then not working every time, actually makes it even more inconvenient because you think of the times you go to pay with your phone because that's the convenient thing to do. It didn't work. Try again. Try one last time. Okay, fine. Now I'll get my wallet and I'll do it. What's that, Jason?
Oh, no, sorry. I was going to say, and then your battery dies. It goes back to number one. Like you're out there and then your battery dies. Oh, and if you don't have your wallet and you're only using that to pay, then you're in trouble. So it does go back to the battery life.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, or before the show, we were talking about the summon feature in the Tesla that you can summon your, you can summon your car with your iPhone app. But what if your battery dies and your car keeps coming right into your house? You would not want that. Battery life.
It's true. I had one time where I had my boarding pass on my phone and I was down to 1%. It was a really late flight. My connection was, and I was down to 1% battery in the line. And I was like, please don't die before I get to the line where they could scan my phone.
Oh my goodness.
On this battery problem, and you reminded me here with the airport story. One reason why battery goes down so much is that there are so many apps that are tracking your location all the time. And that made our list this year as well. Pinging your GPS is one of the biggest ways you can suck down the battery life on a phone. And many of the biggest airline apps do that. They're constantly geofencing you in that airport. So at that moment when you most need the battery, they're making it worse.
Mm. Yeah. Mm,
that actually explains a lot. Because I always feel like my, again, back to battery, but my battery never lasts as long when I'm out of my normal environment, you know, when I'm away from where I live and stuff, and when I'm traveling, especially where you need your battery to last even longer. That actually explains it a lot, that the apps that you have, you know, they're kind of tracking where you are, you know, to make things more convenient for you.
All right, now the tabs, browser tabs. I remember when browser tabs were first invented, and I loved them. But now I have a billion open at once, and it's not easy to close them, and it's not easy to know which one is playing music loudly when I turn my sound on. What's going on with browser tabs?
Right. We've had them for over 10 years. The browser has not really evolved. It's time for some better ideas about how to manage kind of our virtual world across all these things. One thing that we found that sometimes can work and be helpful for people is Tab Wrangler, which works in Chrome and kind of closes and saves the ones that you've been neglecting for a while. But I haven't really seen any other good ideas on this one.
Tab Wrangler. Okay. Well, did we miss any? Are there any more gripes that anyone... Air them now or forever hold your peace.
Yep. Can't complain after this.
Those are the big ones.
Yeah, I think we got them.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for joining us. Jeff Fowler is at the Wall Street Journal. And tell us where what you're working on or what you have up besides this gripe story.
Well, we've got this. And then last week I did a piece that has been really popular. It's kind of if you take an hour and want to improve your online security and your digital privacy, it takes you through the steps of what to do. Nice. So definitely worth an hour of your time to not become hacker bait.
Yes.
All right, Jeff. And we should say that Joanna Stern also participated in griping with you. And yes. There's a great video I highly recommend you guys were at. Was that in San Francisco or New York City that you
did that? It was. Yeah, so we were out protesting together in the streets of San Francisco, some of these tech gripes. And as you might imagine, we got some colorful residents of certain parks that wanted to join in.
I can imagine.
Well, take care, Jeff, and take care of your cold as well.
Thank you, Jeff.
Take care.
All right, coming up, we're going to chat with the other Jason about the release of his new book and what it takes to make it happen. But first, let's take a minute to thank the sponsor of this episode. That's Wealthfront. You invest for the long term, for you, for your family's financial health. Trying to do that all yourself the right way is complex. It's time consuming. It's confusing to me. Luckily, there's Wealthfront. Traditional advisors charge huge fees between 1% to 3% of what they manage. But with Wealthfront, you pay 0.25% a year. That's 25 basis points, zero commissions, no hidden fees, less than $5 a month. To invest a $30,000 account. There are no additional charges for any of Wealthfront's services. You can get started investing right away, today, for as little as $500. It only takes a few minutes to sign up. You go to Wealthfront.com and it goes right to work monitoring your portfolios around the clock, taking action as soon as those opportunities arise. And Wealthfront is transparent as well as accessible. You can view all your accounts in one place, whether they're personal, joint, or retirement, all in a single place. You can also see every trade that Wealthfront makes on your behalf in your dashboard, on your desktop, or the mobile app. And did you know that more than 90% of portfolios aren't invested the right way for the long term? Super important, obviously. With Wealthfront's new portfolio review, you can see if your portfolio is at risk, how diversified your investments are, what you're losing to fees, even minimize your taxes, all for free. Wealthfront's process is based on Nobel Prize winning academic research and the best investment practices. And we've heard from so many Twit fans who've used Wealthfront and love how they can diversify their portfolios and buy stocks from in-demand companies, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, all commission free. Wealthfront manages over $2.6 billion in client assets. And it's growing rapidly every day. So what are you waiting for? You should definitely check this out. Invest in your future today with Wealthfront. Visit Wealthfront.com/TNT to sign up and get your free personalized investment portfolio. You'll see the customized allocation that they're going to recommend for your profile. And just for Twit listeners, if you sign up to invest, Wealthfront will manage your first $15,000 entirely free of charge for life. Join the many Twit fans who've seen huge success with Wealthfront and claim your offer today at Wealthfront.com/TNT. All right, other Jason Heiner. After a year of kind of, I don't know if there's a name for this, but I named it trickle releasing each chapter of your book to the internet, Follow the Geeks.
Serial publishing.
There we go. That's the better word. They both
had a word.
Than trickle. Yeah. Yes. Let's try and avoid the trickle word going forward. I finally saw its hardcover, hardback release this month. So first of all, congratulations on that. It looks awesome. You covered a lot of ground with this book, obviously, and we've definitely talked about it on the network before, but it's interesting to kind of see the transition from kind of this digital experiment into something that's tangible that people are used to seeing. Starting there, out of everything that you covered, what would you say is the one thing that stands out as kind of the most surprising detail? It could be a bit of information about people covered in the book or something about the process that really surprised you.
Sure. Yeah. You know, the thing that was really interesting and that was a big surprise was how excited people were about the process, that we were trying to do this differently and in a new way. And people really sort of grokked what we were doing in a way that we didn't expect, because we were doing a lot of things that were different. And at first we sort of realized we were throwing a lot at people. We started by crowdfunding it, and then we were serial publishing it. So as we finished the chapters, we released them online for a month until we released the next chapter. And in that period, we were asking people for feedback. One, they would tell us about typos. They would tell us, maybe you got this part a little bit wrong or what. Mm-hmm. About this. I also asked them to give us their feedback on, like, what were the insights in this person's story? Because each chapter stood alone as the story of one really important digital innovator, you know, innovator for the digital age. And what was it about their story that resonated with you and their insights that sort of meant something to you? And we were telling people, look, we're going to take the best of those insights and we're going to publish them at the end of the chapters when we actually, you know, finish this book and publish it and put it all together in traditional kind of form. So we were throwing a lot at people. But our idea was, it was all based on this idea that, you know, books hadn't really changed a whole lot since Gutenberg. And, you know, for the digital age, we felt like you could do this in a way that could make a book even better, you know, better than ever. And so by involving your readers and making them part of it, you know, and crowdfunding was part of that too. You know, instead of being responsible to a publisher, we made ourselves responsible to our most loyal users, the ones who were willing to pay for this thing like over a year before it actually launched. So we made ourselves responsible to our readers, and then we also were asking them to be part of the process. And what was surprising was how much they really how many people really dug that part of it, you know, as much as the book itself and the content, they really dug the idea of like, let's do this in a different way and let's have readers be part of it and sort of create a community around the ideas that were in this book, which was really focused around the future of work and that the future is more entrepreneurial, that the digital world is changing the way people do work. It's becoming much more entrepreneurial. It's becoming much more self-driven. There are a lot more people that are, you know, running their own business or running a side business or starting their own consultancy or, you know, freelancing and having multiple gigs at the same time that they kind of manage rather than one sort of traditional full-time kind of gig. And so, you know, with that world, knowing that that was where the world was going or believing that that was where the world is going, you know, we found 10 people who embodied that and had to, in many cases, they were locked in entrepreneurs, but had to become entrepreneurs to pursue kind of the thing that they were most passionate about or where they saw sort of their future, where they felt like they could make a contribution. And so we told these stories with that in mind. And you know, we talked a lot about the obstacles they had to overcome and the challenges they faced and all that. So that made it super fun. And of course, you know, a lot of these are people that are well known to the TWIT network, since you know, TWIT is always trying to find people who are digital innovators and you know, benefit from their wisdom and help your audience benefit from their wisdom too.
So there's a big age range too.
Yeah.
Maya Penn, who was the last one in your chapter, she's 15. I won't say who the oldest one is, but I think I might know. But what's changed about being a geek over the years, or, you know, I guess, you know, all of these people are still in the world innovating. So, but what's changed over the years? Did you learn anything about that as you were writing this book?
Yeah, sure. So I think that, you know, what hasn't been there with that is just the passion. You know, becoming a geek has, the definition of geek has evolved into like something that is so, you know, you have a passion to do something. And it started out like a passion for computers, right? Technology. And you were so interested in it that you wanted to know the intricacies of how it worked. And you almost had to be a geek to, you know, make computers work at first. You had to be really interested in all of these things. And you had to be your own, essentially what we call now, like integrator, right? You had to figure out how all these things worked and IRQs and, you know, which ports to plug your accessories in and how to make the, which accessories worked right with which machine and all of those kinds of things. And over time, you know, as those things have gotten easier and better, you know, it's evolved into, you know, software and, you know, coding your own thing or building your own website, which is more like markup language and, you know, images and, you know, being able to create your own thing, or in many ways, people to teach yourself that way, that ethic that it took to sort of get a computer running originally. And now people apply that to a lot of different things, which is to be able to teach yourself, you know, something like Blender, which is this sort of 3D animation software, or be able to figure out how to build your own website or build your own e-commerce platform or build your own email newsletter or build your own, you know, platform where you, you know, service all of your community and your users. So it's broadened so much, but really at the heart of it is this idea of being a geek is like being self-taught, being curious, having passion about, you know, the things that you can do with technology and the things that just were never possible before that now, you know, one person can do and teach themselves something that it used to take a whole team of people to pull off. And that's pretty exciting. And that's why it's so much easier to start your own company, to take your idea and really run with it in an exciting new way instead of going on about it because it's stuff that we're super passionate about.
Sure, sure. Now, finally, obviously, the process of releasing every chapter every month for free was you know, pretty unique. Now we have, like I said, the traditional hardcover copy of the book. Is this a format that you would follow again? Do you have plans for kind of like a follow-up to do maybe something along similar lines from a content perspective, but definitely from a format perspective? What do you think?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. This is the way I always wanted to do a book. Like I'd done a couple of books the old-fashioned way, you know, like 10 years ago, and did not really like the process. Felt like it did not fit well with the digital age. And so I had always wanted to do it, but it, you know, stuff takes so much time. And so it wasn't until I found a partner to do it with, Lindsay Gilpin, who really got the idea and really was into it and really kind of helped evolve it too. Like the crowdfunding was really her idea. That was a perfect, you know, thing to pair with, you know, with my idea, which was really mostly around serial publishing. And then we both kind of evolved this idea of, you know, building this community around the process. And so absolutely, if I was going to do a book again and if I was going to do another one, I would totally do the same thing. There's lots that we learned. Obviously, we knew we would. And there's things that we would sort of tweak the process of doing it. But that was partly why we did it. We knew it was new and different. And we wanted to just, you know, give it a try and learn a lot and see what would happen. And so we're really focused on this book for now. But there's certainly the opportunities we're going to do other kinds of content around this book. We have plans to do some interesting things. There's material that didn't make it into the book. There's also really interesting lessons that are specifically focused on some of the people and some of the ways they did things and also taking wisdom from one story and another story and putting them together that we think make some interesting insights. And so so stay tuned for that. but I would recommend others sort of try this as well and see what they learn from it. We've had others say that they want to try the, you know, the same process. And I really hope that, that they do because it's an incredibly, interesting way to do a book and, useful and, much more fun than to do it, you know, than go away, write for a year and give your thing, you know, to your audience. It's much more fun to bring your audience along for the journey and help them, you know, let them help you refine it. That made it so much more fun. And ultimately, it made it a much, much better book by doing it that way.
That's awesome.
Well, of course, you can buy the book at followthegeeks.com. You can
followthegeeksbook.com.
Followthegeeksbook.com. Yep. Thanks. The paperback, the hardcover, the ebook, the audiobook.
Yeah, audiobook. Dan Patterson's voicing that, right?
Yes, Dan Patterson narrated it and did a brilliant job with it. It's also available on Audible and iTunes as well. The book's available on Amazon. You can get it there as well and Kindle.
all the places where you normally buy your. So it's been a lot of fun. And on Twit Network, we've talked a lot about it too, because you guys have shown, you know, interest from the project from the beginning. So I really appreciate that. It's been fun coming on and talking about it, you know, as we went along in the process.
That's a cool process.
So, it's been lots of fun.
Excellent. Awesome. Well, congratulations on that.
Now it's time for TNT's fan of the day, who is Byron, who tweeted us this video loop saying no harm to cows as he and had his Samsung device mounted in his vehicle watching the show while a stream of cows crosses in front of him in the distance. You're not watching the show while you drive, right?
I hope not. You're just listening, right? It just happens to have video on.
Yeah, I like those looping videos. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup. Post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, Facebook. Use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT and we will find it. Now up next, what happens when a legendary rocker teams up with Skype to create a new way to communicate? But first, let's take a minute to thank the sponsor of this episode, the Ring Video Doorbell. We all know what the sound of a doorbell sounds like. It means a package is being delivered or friends are coming over.
It sounds a little there like that. Is that the sound of a doorbell?
That's the sound of my doorbell. It also could be the sound of someone planning to rob you. Mm-hmm. Over 95% of home break-ins happen during the day, and burglars almost always start by ringing your doorbell first to case the joint. Then they pillage your possessions. With the Ring Video Doorbell, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. Ring's advanced motion detection alerts you even if someone doesn't ring your doorbell. With Ring Video Doorbell, you can talk to delivery people and keep an eye on your package. If someone tries to mess with it, you'll get an instant alert and an HD video of the whole thing. It's like having a neighbor keep an eye on your home 24/7. I use the Ring Video Doorbell. It's great for when my kids get dropped off. I know they're home even if I'm still at work. The motion sensor gives me alert on my watch, on my phone. It's awesome. Installing Ring takes minutes, and it works either with your current wiring or your built-in rechargeable battery. So put your mind at ease and protect your home with the Video Doorbell. Time Magazine and USA Today named one of their top 10 gadgets of 2015. Go to ring.com/TNT for free expedited FedEx shipping. That's ring.com/TNT. With Ring, you're always home.
All right. So I'm a Beatles fan. What do the Beatles and Emoji have in common?
Everything.
Paul McCartney. Duh. Skype and Paul McCartney have created 10 new moving emojis inside Skype. Skype calls them, well, Skype basically takes off the E, so it just calls them emojis for some reason.
Memoji.
They're created for Valentine's Day. Each of them features some sound and music that Paul McCartney wrote, actually, specifically for the project. So if you are a Beatles completionist, you're going to want to get in on some of these, I suppose, and use them. He says they're built with love in mind, as you can see there.
All you need is love.
Nice.
All right. I think it's interesting that Skype thought, let's get Paul McCartney to put some sounds to our emojis. Like, just not the kind of thing you think of hiring Paul McCartney to do, but I guess he spent a couple of days of experimenting with different sounds and everything, and I don't know. I'm an audio nerd, so I love this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I love emojis, so together we love Moji.
Like, just going in and playing in that playground for a couple of days with Paul McCartney would be so awesome. I don't know how far this is going to go, how much it's going to be used. You've got Sumo Cupid, Excited Octopus, Flirting Banana. That's just a couple of them. But it's kind of interesting, I suppose. Our artist-collaborated emoji, the wave of the future. What do you think, Jason?
Man, it's interesting take emoji to the next level, right? It's funny because it's like emojis have splintered now. Now there's like stickers and there's the emoji from Skype.
And then there's animated GIF and
exactly.
All over the place. Like
in Slack, you know, you can put animated GIFs, which is fun. And so, yeah, it is interesting. And there's like GIF keyboards in your in your phone that you can use as well. And so it's certainly kicking up the text and messaging game, instant messaging game, to another level. So that is kind of fun.
Well, Jason, thank you so much for joining us. Jason Heiner is the editor in chief at Tech Republic.
Yes.
And at Jason Heiner on Twitter. And check out Follow the Geeks at followthegeeksbook.com.
There we go. That's it. That's
yes,
it.
Very good. Awesome. One more plug for that, too, is we're offering, to celebrate kind of the launch, we're offering a free laptop sticker. So if anybody wants a Follow the Geeks laptop sticker, just go to followthegeeksbook.com, click on the contact form, and send us your mailing address, and we will send them anywhere in the world. We will send you a Follow the Geeks laptop sticker.
Nice. Look at that. Awesome. Jason, congratulations once again, and thank you so much for coming on today. We'd love to have you back sometime soon.
Thanks, Jason and Megan. Always a pleasure, and you guys take care. Talk to you soon.
Right. Bye-bye. Take care, you too. And we will be welcoming Selena Larson from The Daily Dot on tomorrow's show. Looking forward to that. TNT records live every Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 12 a.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can always take part in the show by emailing us at tnt@twit.tv. You can also leave us a short voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. And you can find us on Twitter. The show is at TechNewsTodayTV.
You will never miss a show if you subscribe. And you can find all the ways to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. And you can subscribe to the Twit newsletter at twit.tv/newsletter. If you want to tweet at me, I am at Megan Maroney. You can also send me your tech gripes. You can also send those to Megan at twit.tv. We got to say ours, but I think if you got tech gripes, send them to me at Megan at twit.tv or to TNT at twit.tv.
That's right. I am at Jason Howell on Twitter. Thanks to our technical director, Anthony Nielsen, and all the folks who help us produce this show every single day, even if they are fans of the new YouTube Red content. And thanks to you for talking tech with us. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye, everyone.